Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your moderator for the program tonight. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. He served as special assistant to President Ronald Reagan for national security affairs from 1983 to 1989, and from 1987 to 1989 as special assistant to the President for international security affairs. He was the executive secretary for President Reagan's summits with Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev in Geneva in 1985 and in Reykjavik, Iceland in 1986. He served in the United States Army from 1963 until he retired as a colonel in 1987. During the span of his career, he served overseas in Vietnam, Germany, and Italy. He was a tenured professor at West Point from 1977 to 1983 and has lectured at many major universities in the United States, the former Soviet Union, the present Russia, and China. He currently is CEO of the Nevada Northern Network and was appointed to be the civilian aide to the Secretary of the Army in 2005, where he represents the Secretary in Nevada on defense and national security issues. This February 6th, President Ronald Reagan would have turned 100. A participant in many private meetings with President Reagan and many world leaders, our speaker will share with us tonight his intimate perspectives on President Reagan and his relationships with such world leaders as Gorbachev, Lady Margaret Thatcher, Brian Mulroney, Helmut Kohl, and Pope John Paul II. He will provide first-hand insights into the role of other participants in those epic times as well, including President George H.W. Bush, Tip O'Neill, Colin Powell, George Shultz, Oliver North, and Bob Gates. Please join me in giving a Commonwealth Club welcome to our distinguished speaker, Dr. Tyrus W. Cobb.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank God. Well, thanks to everyone, and it's a pleasure to be back in the Commonwealth Club after several years. I was a member and always enjoyed attending meetings here. As Skip Rhodes pointed out, in just 2 weeks, we're going to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of President Ronald Reagan, who I think was one of the most caring, decent, kind, and intelligent individuals, and somebody who stewarded the United States through a most turbulent time, particularly during the Cold War and dealing with many crises that faced us between us and the Soviet Union. If you look at this cartoon, I think many of us look back after some turbulent times, contemporary, and as it said here, the couple's talking to the marriage counselor, and she said, "I gave him the best years of my life, the Reagan years." He was, in Peggy Noonan's phrase, simply a beautiful man, and he always at his side was his wife, Nancy. Nancy was his guiding light. They were extraordinarily close. She was a significant advisor to the president to include relating to Soviet affairs. The president always had a wonderful sense of humor. He could always diffuse a tense meeting by telling an anecdote or a story. I remember the president wrote in his memoirs one day, he said, "We had a difficult time today. My intelligence people tell me that Castro thinks that I'm up to something." He said, "I'm staying awake tonight trying to think of something to cause him to justify his worrying." Or one time, he had a difficult time with some of his children, principally Ron and Patty. And Patty Davis, in her rebellious years, refused Secret Service protection. And Reagan just shook his head and said, "You know, I'm convinced that insanity is hereditary. You get it from your kids." You know, in the old days, they used to, if they made a movie, and they would go to the town or the area where the movie was made for the premiere. And this one was called Virginia City, so they did it nearby Reno, Nevada. Do you recognize people in this photograph, by the way? Right, yes. There's Hopalong Cassidy. And who's that in the middle? Errol Flynn. And then a little bit off to the side, way off to the side, Ronald Reagan. I put this up because there was sort of a recurring theme that will go through this of Reagan the cowboy, which was not always said in a most positive way. And here's another view of a group of cowboys that were involved in a Western. Certainly you see there Ronald Reagan, and I don't know if you recognize anybody else. Our radio audience certainly wouldn't. But once again, Hopalong Cassidy, and over there on the far left, Humphrey Bogart. That was the way that they would do those things. But the idea of Reagan the cowboy, it was derided in Europe, you know, this doddering old fool, what does he know? Especially when Mikhail Gorbachev came along and they were drawing contrasts between the two. Reagan relied on very few people as close advisors, but Senator Paul Laxalt of Nevada, they were governors together of the two states. And Paul Laxalt was always one of the foundations that Reagan could rely on, one of his just closest friends. His chief advisor, his counselor from the days in California, later his attorney general, and for 4 years his counselor was Ed Meese. And the triumvirate that ran the White House in the first few years was an unusual mix, because Jim Baker, who became chief of staff, came to them from the George Bush campaign, and the rivalry during that campaign got pretty heated. But Jim brought some extraordinary organizational skills. He spoke to the Commonwealth Club not too far back, made a great talk. The two Californians here, Ed Meese and Mike Deaver, came up together. But I would be lying if I said that everything went rosy, because Deaver really kind of split away from the conservatives and Ed Meese, and there was no little friction within in the White House. The issue of the Soviet Union was not primary in the president's mind when he came to office, and my wife Sue Ellen and I were in Moscow at the time, and I gave a talk to several Soviets, including officers from the KGB and military intelligence, and said, "Don't wait for the president to want to meet with the Soviet leader, Brezhnev." And they said, "Well, that's always the first thing a president does." And I said, "Not this president. He's not ready." Because the perception globally after President Carter's reign was that the Soviet economy was in a period of surge. They were riding high on oil and gas revenues. Their influence was spreading because the wars of national liberation seemed to be picking up in Afghanistan and Angola in Central America. And the U.S. seemed to still be recoiling from the defeat in Vietnam. There was the Watergate scandal, the resignation of the president. The economy went into the doldrums. There was the energy shock of 73, followed by the energy shock of 79. Perhaps best summarized by President Carter when he complained about the country having suffering from a state of malaise. Who was the Soviet leader initially? You may recall Leonid Brezhnev, replete with many of his medals, including Geroi Sovietskoga Soyuza, Hero of the Soviet Union. He was a political commissar in World War II. And you can resplendent in his medals, but Brezhnev was getting very old. He was, obviously, they all drank a lot. The Soviet Union was run by often people would say an oligarchy, a rule of just a few in the Politburo, but it was really increasingly a rule by the gerontocracy, the rule by the old. So what was Reagan's strategy for dealing with the Soviet Union? He didn't have a grand strategy. We like to pretend like we did, because things turned out well in the end. But he felt that before he can sit down with Brezhnev or any other Soviet leader, we needed to restore the U.S. economy, get it moving again. Sound familiar? Had to restore American military strength, which in his mind had dwindled since Vietnam. But most importantly, he wanted to restore the absence, the confidence of the United, of the American people. In some, no rush to go deal with the Soviet Union. He concentrated on domestic affairs, principally working with the leader, co-chairman of the Republican Party, his good friend Paul Laxalt. But Reagan also had a very interesting relationship with the domestic leadership on the other side, because while the Senate went to the hands of the Republicans, the Democrats retained control of the House of Representatives. And as you see here, along with Howard Baker, Republican on the right, the venerable Tip O'Neill, the lion from Massachusetts, the stalwart liberal. And I can remember Reagan and Tip O'Neill would go at it all during the day, and Tip would say, "Mr. President, you're trying to restore the American economy on the backs of the working people, and you don't care about the middle class." And Reagan said, "Tip, you know, if it was up to you, we would destroy the capitalist system because you wanted to rob all the people who contribute to the wealth of this country." And then Reagan would say, "Well, Tip, why don't you come on over tonight and we'll have a drink and chat." And so the two Irishmen would get together at night and have a, you know, Reagan didn't really drink, but he would sip and they'd tell jokes and Irish jokes and anecdotes. You know, it's a civility that's absent these days. Now let's turn to foreign affairs. It was very important to Reagan before he dealt with the Soviets. He wanted to restore the alliance. We had felt that the NATO alliance had crumbled. There were deep fissures. And unfortunately for us, the leader in one of our most important allies countries, Canada, was Pierre Trudeau. And the relationship between Reagan and Trudeau was like acid and water. The enmity between them was very noticeable. In December 1983, Pierre came to a meeting in the Oval Office, and then we had a press conference afterwards. You can see in this photo how terribly happy we all were with that meeting. Myself on the left, and then Rick Burt and Bud McFarlane, my boss, Ambassador Paul Robinson, Secretary Cap Weinberger, and Secretary George Shultz. The frowns on everybody's face let you know that the meeting did not go well and the relationship was not too cool. But Trudeau's popularity sunk below 16%. They were forced to call elections. And who comes in? Another Irishman, a conservative leader for Canada, Brian Mulroney. And Brian and President Reagan hit it off. They became very close. They shared a lot of similar views on the world, despite a lot of the antagonism that existed between the United States and Canada. But the relationship just brightened, and it was really a part of a trend toward conservatives come into power in a number of countries, including Germany and England. But more importantly, even those areas where socialists were in control, there was a unanimity in views on how to deal with the Soviet Union. But the relationship with Brian Mulroney remained one of the closest between them. This is just a shot, and every time we would have a meeting, a summit meeting, before we had the larger meeting, 9-on-9 or whatever it would be, there would be a one-on-one in the Oval Office. And this was Ambassador Derek Burney, who later became a head of the National Hockey League, and myself in there in the Oval Office with the President and Brian Mulroney. Well, you know who this lady is, don't you? Margaret Thatcher. Great influence on the President. And this is a person who was never afraid to speak her mind. Mrs. Thatcher would literally walk into the Oval Office and without any formalities in her handbag, fly in, she'd just come in like this and nod to everybody else and just say, "Ron, you know, you're going to meet with Gorbachev. Now, here's what you need to do." And she'd start going, and Ron would say, "Yes, Maggie." And she said, "No, we need to get serious on this, and this is the approach that we need to take." He said, "I understand, Margaret. Yes, that's what we're going to do. Well, we got to be firm here." And then Reagan look over at us and wink, you know. And but it was an extremely close relationship. Mrs. Thatcher, who's still alive, and I was helping on a biography a fellow named Daniel Collins is doing. Mrs. Thatcher was a wonderful advisor to the president. She became an extremely close friend, and the alliance between the British and the Americans was never stronger. This is a photo at Camp David, the two of them taking a stroll together. I'll just tell you one other story about how Mrs. Thatcher was. When we were at the Venice Economic Summit, the G8, in 1987, because President Reagan was senior in protocol as a head of state, she was a head of government, she came to the hotel where we were staying, and we had our one-on-one meeting and a group meeting. And then, because it was Venice, the advance team had devised the idea that Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher would ride in a gondola together across the water to the meeting. And two aides, myself for the president and another, Charles Poole for the Brit, went in the gondola. And I got to tell her, the whole way over in the gondola, she was still lecturing him on, you know, what we're going to do in the G8 meeting. And I was sitting there, we're on a gondola, and she couldn't stop it. A lovely lady. You know, as my friend Skip Rhode said, a lot of people don't understand that when we talk about the alliance in the countries of Western Europe, that the Pope John Paul was the head of state, as well as the spiritual leader of Catholics around the world. And I know you're going to get this wrong unless you've heard this twice, like Dick and Joe. What's the name of the state that the Pope heads up? No, not the Vatican. The Holy See. The official name is the Holy See. So the Pope is regarded as, in protocol wise, as the head of state for the Holy See, and President Reagan's head of state in the United States. He's also the head of government. I don't know any other country where this role is there. But the two of them developed a very close relationship, and among many things on their minds, where they had a synonymity of views, was the desire to liberate Eastern Europe from the Soviet yoke. And Pope John Paul, remember, where was he from? Poland. He's the Polish Pope. And for the Pope, bringing freedom to Poland was extraordinarily important. Every time we would have a meeting, as you saw with the Canadians or with the Brits, we was one-on-one with just either interpreter or note taker or whatever. But with Pope, the Pope wouldn't allow anybody else in. He always went for those meetings one-on-one. But we do know in those meetings that the president had with the Pope, they shared a desire to liberate Eastern Europe and particularly Poland. And they agreed on a strategy that included primarily propaganda broadcasts, monetary aid to the Polish trade union movement, Solidarity, but it also included some armaments for the dissidents in that country. And much of it was shipped to the Polish Solidarity by the AFL-CIO, who was a very close ally with the president in freeing Poland. And during my time there, we met with the Pope three times, twice in the Vatican. We were going through the line, and as we got there, the president said, bless you. And I said, Ojenkuya, Proshipani. And the Pope said, Ojenkuya. This was all I knew of Polish, was thank you and you're welcome. And so we said that, and people overheard it, and the Secret Service was talking to me afterwards. Said, "Well, what was that conversation you and the Pope were having?" I said, "Well, I can't tell you." But there's been very little written about this. I'm going to try to write up something one of these days. But that relationship with the Pope and the President was very important. A difficult relationship we had with the French. We always, you know, I don't care who it is, you always have a difficult relationship with the French. But the president of France at that time was whom? Francois Mitterrand. He came into office, he became a socialist, was a leader in the resistance in World War II, later became a socialist, became the president running on the socialist ticket, and immediately plunged the French economy into a resuscitation in his mind by really developing a very socialist-oriented economy. But by 1983, that economy had failed badly. So later, when Mitterrand came to the United States for meetings, he was in a very different mode than he was in 1982 or 83, where he thought things were working. By 1984, 85, it was clear that model hadn't worked. So he came to the United States, took a tour. He went to the Silicon Valley. He went to Carnegie Mellon. He went to centers down in Atlanta, where we really saw the high-tech machine in the United States working. And he took back a lot of ideas. But I thought this was, in view of the president's speech tonight, Mitterrand's chief of staff later told me, I said, well, how did the trip go? He said, well, Mitterrand thought it was wonderful, but he called a cabinet meeting. And he said, I'm so impressed by the American spirit of entrepreneurial attitude and innovation. And he turned to his chief and said, now let's see how the state can best organize that. he said, you missed the point. I'll tell you another funny story. I think it was at this meeting. This actually took place in 1986 on Governor's Island in New York, celebrating the 100th anniversary of what? The French giving the Statue of Liberty to the United States. Beautiful day like today in San Francisco, tall ships sailing the harbor. And we got talking about economics, and the president kind of set up in Iran. He says, well, Francois, tell me about this new economic program. They had abandoned the socialist model, and he sort of explained it. Reagan said, well, I don't know, Francois, but it sounds an awful lot like Reaganomics to me. He says, well, you can call it what you want, Mr. President, but it's working. Oh, one story I want to tell. We had this meeting in this very small dining room that the Coast Guard commandant had, and so we had to squeeze everybody, Ambassador Ridgway and myself, down at the end, and it kind of looks like they're toasting us. But this is not a good picture of her, but the lady at the end is Yvette Guigeau. And after one of our meetings of eight came in, and in comes this girl that looks like Brigitte Bardot did back in 1956. We had our meeting. This was in London at the G8 meeting. And as they were leaving, the president turned to us, and our ambassador, Van Galbraith, was there. And he said, Van, who is that lovely young lady with Francois? He said, Van said, oh, Mr. President, that's Yvette Guigeau. And he said, well, what does she do? Oh, that's his economics advisor. And the president said, oh, what does she know about economics? Oh, Mr. President, she knows this. And he said, okay, Van, okay. Tell Francois the next time you see him that I'll trade him straight across for my economics advisor, Marty Feldstein, and I'll throw in a Cadillac. Also, Dean, with France, you may recall the president made a very poignant trip in June 6, 1984. It was the 40th anniversary of the landing of D-Day. You recognize this is at the Pointe du Hoc. This is the cliffs, 260 feet high, where the Rangers, some of whom are assembled in this photo here, climbed up directly in the face of the German gun emplacements and seized the German positions and held the day as we moved forward on D-Day. This is the beyond in the background, Omaha and Utah beaches. But because of this, the president extolled them. He called them the boys of Pointe du Hoc. That and one of the most emotional moments that I can recall being with the president. And later that day, there was a ceremony on the beach, all of the allied nations. And then at Omaha Beach, the president and Mrs. Reagan walking through the cemetery, a very difficult time. Well, we also dealt with the Italians. Italians were wonderful. I loved them. We lived there. My wife and I were married there. And the Italians were different because there was a multi-party system. And so when they would come, they'd have to have a group of a gaggle of 10 or 11 representing all the different factions. And so when the president would be looking at his talking points, of course, there would be the big issues about the deployment of the Glickums, the cruise missiles, but also there would be everything else under the sun. Like, I remember Parma ham imports being a big issue to some Italian. So the president would look at his notes, and we're getting ready for these meetings. He said, I said, Mr. President, remember, for the Italians, it's the important thing to remember is fare una bella figura. You got to look good. Just take a photo op with all of them, tell jokes, and everybody be happy. And that's what we did. So we didn't get too bogged down, but when you dealt with the Italians, there was just a multiplicity of groups. One of the more important relationships, of course, was always with Germany. Now, it's easy for us to look back 30 years later and say, well, look how things have gone so well with in Germany. I got to tell you, at that time, nobody knew. The big question that dominated Europe was whither Germany. The question was, is Germany going to revert back to be the dominant force in Central Europe, equidistant from Moscow and the United States, the commanding power there? Or was it going to follow sort of the Willy Brandt line and be the link to Moscow and, you know, very close relationships? Or was it going to be the old Konrad Adenauer, Ludwig Erhard, very close relationship with the United States? We didn't know. Chancellor Kohl came in. He was never in a strong political position. He was a rock-hard conservative, good friend of the president. And so what Kohl would do is, you know, we get the president a couple times. He said, you know, you got to come to Germany. Well, our relationship strengthened. Kohl was a good supporter, as was Germany, West Germany. Remember, it was West Germany at the time. But then Kohl came up with this idea that you may have heard of. He said, he called Reagan one day, said, Mr. President, you know, Ron, I just came back from Verdun, where President Mitterrand of France and I buried the hatchet forever. We were there with, there was the war dead from both Germany and France, and we sealed our friendship forever. It was very important to me. We need to do the same thing. So Reagan said, oh, okay. So we're going to do the same thing at a cemetery in Germany. Only problem was we didn't leave any war dead in Germany. We moved them to Luxembourg or back to the United States. They said, well, that's okay. Well, what are we going to do? Well, there's a cemetery called Bitburg, and there's only Germans there, but we'll go there. Okay, so our advance team went there. It was a snowy day. They didn't check it out too closely, so we're going to meet at Bitburg. Well, folks, guess who's buried in the Bitburg Cemetery? Not just German soldiers, but the SS, the Waffen-SS. So suddenly a furor erupts around the world. We are going to go to the cemetery where the Waffen-SS is buried. And Chancellor Kohl comes back and said, correctly, I think, Mr. President, Ron, if you don't go with me to Bitburg, what you are saying is you can't trust Germany. And we will go on a different course from that of Ludwig Erhard and Adenauer. We will become independent. We will be a link, a Brücke, a bridge. So we were saying, Mr. President, can Bitburg go anywhere else? Go to the Adenauer Memorial. And finally, Reagan came to us and said, now I know some of you have been talking to your German counterparts, but I told the chancellor, I'm going to Bitburg, and I'm going. So we said, okay. Well, guess what happens? Totally coincidentally, who comes to the White House 3 weeks before we are leaving for Bitburg to get the Medal of Freedom, the Congressional Medal of Freedom? Who was that? Elie Weitzel, concentration camp survivor, eloquent spokesperson for those who perished in the concentration camps in Auschwitz and others. And he comes to the White House 3 weeks before we're going and says, do not make this visit. Mr. President, I beseech you, do not honor the Waffen-SS. Please do not go to Bitburg. Well, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. Well, we wound up going, and I think the way you've seen Germany go, it was a wise decision, but extremely difficult. A lot of people ask me, were there any very close calls? I mean, because both the Soviet Union and the United States were armed to the teeth. Some we knew about. We knew that tensions were rising. When I was there, when Suellen and I were there, I was studying the Soviet National Security Decision-Making System, and one of the things I noticed is that they tended to funnel all their recommendations through a very narrow KGB, Central Committee channel, so the president wasn't getting a wide spectrum of, or the general secretary. And the analyses, in addition, tended to be the worst case. I saw this, that therefore they're planning. And increasingly, by 1983, with their military build-up, particularly the Strategic Defense Initiative, they begin to think the Americans are planning a first strike. We know they're going to plan a first strike. We got to be prepared. So one day, true story, I've got it here, the Soviet radar, they're already skittish from previous years when the Korean airliners had penetrated their airspace twice. And now they're skittish, and they get the signals from their radars. The Americans have launched the first strike. The missiles have launched. The order went down to one site, launched a retaliatory strike. A Lieutenant Colonel Petrov was there and said, I can't do it. 3 minutes later, what happened? I am not going to do it. Colonel, you must fire those rockets. We've indications they've launched this. No, I'm not. Well, you're relieved. Then turn it over, and they said, wait a minute, we just got a correction. There was a flock of birds in Montana. We came that close to launching Armageddon. We didn't know it at the time, but we knew that the miscalculation was possible. That's on the one extreme. Let me tell you a story about the other extreme. Again, as Skip Rhodes said, I was in charge of coordinating relations with European countries as well as working Soviet issues. And there's only two of us did all of West Europe, and it's included Iceland. So one day I get a call from the Icelandic ambassador, and I hardly knew him, and he called me. And I said, Mr. Ambassador, what a pleasure. What's on your mind? And he was obviously agitated. He says, Dr. Cobb, I just want you to be the first to know that tomorrow Iceland is breaking diplomatic relations with the United States, and you'll be out of your base in Keflavik in a year. Well, this is, remember, Hunt for the Red October time. The Soviet boomers, the SLBMs, they had to go out from a warm water port up north, and they had to go through this narrow Iceland-United Kingdom gap. Our Navy P-3s flying out of Keflavik kept track of them. Whoa, this is pretty serious. And I said, well, Mr. Ambassador, the issue, of course, is, and he said, well, Wales, of course. Said, Wales. Wales the country, Cod War. Wales the mammal. So I said, let me get right back to you. So I called the State Department, and I said, what in the hell is going on here? He said, oh, yeah, it's really serious. I said, what's the issue? Well, in a nutshell, the International Whaling Commission had decided that we would not, the word is harvest, kill whales anymore. And they believed that the United States was behind it, and this was their cultural heritage. And they were right. We were behind it, our NOAA and Department of Commerce. So I said, well, you know, because I'm talking, well, what does state want to do? Well, Secretary Shultz says, you know, screw the whales. Let's save the base. And the guys at defense at the undersecretary level were saying, yeah, whatever we've got to do, you know, whales are nice, but we probably got a few of them. So we wound up the next day, crisis meeting in the Oval Office with Cap Weinberger, George Shultz, myself, and we got talking on this, and the president turned to me and said, well, Ty, how many whales are there? I didn't know. So I mean, I said, I'll be right back. So I called Commerce, NOAA, the Oceanographic Administration, said, the deputy administrator said, got a call from the White House, and he said, well, what do you need? And I said, the president wants to know how many whales there are. And he said, what? I said, listen, you got 10 minutes. Call me back and tell me how many whales there are. And I'll never forget, he called back in 10 minutes, and he said, 739,645. I don't know where he got the number. I went back in the Oval Office and said, Mr. President, you know, it didn't matter. It's a Bambi issue. It didn't matter how many. It's species-specific and all that. But that just gives you a general idea how that went. A funny thing happened, though. As we went to the final decision in the Oval Office, what we were going to do about this, State Department, Shultz spoke first and said, you know, we got to, whatever the Icelanders want, we got to do this. And then came to Cap Weinberger, from San Francisco, Bechtel, and hardline conservative. And Cap said, you know, Mr. President, I don't know. I think this is a matter of principle, and we've got to stand behind our stance on the International Whaling Commission. I about fell out of my seat. The Secretary of Defense, conservative Cap Weinberger, what's he doing? You know, and it's, anyway, We worked out a compromise, and it was years later when I came out west to take over Yosemite National Institutes, which we did environment and science education in national parks. I noticed that Cap Weinberger had been on a board back in the day with Robert Redford and Bill Anders, and I wrote to him and said, I'm taking over this organization. You were on the board. By the way, did that decision on the whales come? Were you impacted by your time at Yosemite? And he said, yeah, definitely. So you get these odd things, too. Well, because we had already worked the alliance so well, we had unity, and things were decaying in the Soviet Union, there was a real sense that, used the Soviet phrase, the correlation of forces, had been reversed. We had sustained economic growth. We were doing SDI. We had a defense buildup. We were countering the Soviets in the world arena by in Afghanistan, arming the Mujahideen in Central America, in Angola. But there's this broad philosophic consensus. And now the president felt, hey, I feel comfortable dealing with the Soviets. Who's at the other end? Well, you saw how old Brezhnev was. He died in 1981. And at the time of his death, if you looked at the Soviet Union, extreme difficulties, the economy was going to pieces, and there's stasis in the leadership. But the president said he was prepared, and we're here in the Oval Office talking about a possible meeting with the Soviets. And the president began preparing for these meetings. This is another meeting in the Oval Office with the Vice President Bush, myself, Secretary Shultz, my boss, Bud McFarlane, Helene von Damm, who became our ambassador to Austria. Well, who succeeded Brezhnev? Not exactly a liberal, the head of the KGB, Yuri Andropov. But Andropov no sooner comes into power, and he gets so sick that he becomes virtually absent. And we had no real communications with the Soviets under Andropov because he was so out of the picture and so sick, almost like Brezhnev was. So within 18 months, Andropov dies. So who takes his place? Now it's time to go for a nice, bright young guy, right? No, Konstantin Chernyenko, 84 years old. He can barely walk to the podium. They wind him up and push him across the stage. And so we had another year of, as the president said, well, I'd like to do business with the Soviet Union, but they keep dying on me. Or he said, I call them on the phone and nobody answers. And, you know, it was a joke, but it was half true. Finally, March 1985, who comes to power? Mikhail Gorbachev, bright young reformer. He captures the spirit. He's going to open up the Soviet society through glasnost, and he's going to restructure their economy through perestroika, captures the imagination of the West Europeans. They don't want to deploy the missiles. There's hundreds of thousands in the streets against the Pershing missile and the Glickums being deployed. And derision about, well, who's the... We got this bright young reformer coming out of Moscow, and we have this tired, old, doddering cowboy. By the way, you know who took this photo? It was our beloved friend Galen Rowell up on Highway 49. But, you know, it was the cowboy against the bright young reformer. So it's time to get the president ready. We agree on a meeting. We're going to go to Geneva in November 1985. We had some one-on-one or small group meetings with Secretary Shultz and the Vice President in the Oval Office getting ready. And then I was in charge of the preparatory sessions. Here, Fritz Ehrmacht and the Secretary, Bill Casey, who ran the CIA mumbles, Kay Oliver briefing the President, Bob Gates. Bob Gates, by the way, was a very hardliner, cautioning the President against moving forward with the Soviets, that Gorbachev's not a reformer is just a trick. He's a dedicated communist. And so we had a series of these meetings. Again, here is Bob Gates, who was at the time deputy head of the CIA, myself, Cap Weinberger, Dick Pipes, one of the hardline Soviet advisors. But the president said, no, he just disregarded a lot of that advice and said, I'm going to meet with him. I think the time is here. It's time for us to help foment change in the Soviet Union. And the president and myself in this pitch, he was always had a good sense of humor no matter how difficult. And things were getting really pretty difficult at the time. But finally, you know, we're about 3 weeks from the meeting, and we've got four more preparatory sessions and all these books, and the president finally just said, stop. We said, what do you mean stop? He said, no more briefings. Mr. President, we've got 100 issues yet to cover. The president said, you know, I've been preparing for this meeting for 40 years, and if I'm not ready now, I'm never going to be ready. I said, oh, okay. But were we confident? No. But we're going to Geneva, and this is on Air Force One. You can see the president's relaxed. We're not relaxed. We're uptight because Gorby is bright, young. He's captured the imagination of the Europeans, particularly the Germans. And Reagan's confident we go over there. So how do we have that first meeting? It's a bitterly cold. The skies are like San Francisco today, blue, but it's about 20 degrees at best. It's cold as hell. Because Reagan is senior in protocol rank, Gorby has to come to him for the first meeting. And it was where we were staying, where the president was staying at the Aga Khan's restaurant residence. So we're all waiting. Thousands of cameras and press are there. The world is watching the old guy and the bright young reformer. So what happens? Gorby drives up in this big Soviet heavy limousine, a Zhil. He gets out. He's got his coat on. He's got a scarf on. He's got the schlappa. He's all bundled up, and he goes like this. And Reagan opens the door and bounds out with nothing on but this dark blue suit and said, hello, Mr. Gorbachev, how you doing? So we all turned to each other and said, he's got it. And he did. He was prepared for the meetings. I tell you, one funny story. We had said, Mr. President, you know, he wanted a one-on-one. So the president, after about an hour of their going through their talking points, he said, you know, General Secretary Gorbachev, look, we're sitting here reading our talking points to one. Let's go get to know it. Let's just, you and I, go down with our interpreters to the dacha, and we'll just chat. Well, they decided to do that. We were down at the dacha, and we got the signal that they were coming down. That meant start the fire in the fireplace, which we did, and we were looking out the window and looked around. The wind had come up, blew a drapes into the fireplace. The drapes caught on fire. They're walking down, and we're going, stop, don't, you can't come down yet. And, well, they don't understand that they're walking together down the steps pretending they're talking, and we're going, wait. We literally took the drapes out the back door as the general secretary came in with the president. And it was a tense 2.5 days of meetings. And, you know, I thought, well, Gorbachev could just simply walk out of the meeting and capture the European mind and say, I can't deal with this doddering old fool. We're not going to ever get agreement. Because SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, was the big holdup. But that's what I thought might happen. And I'm sitting there at 1 o'clock in the morning, the last day before the ceremony that was scheduled for 8 o'clock that morning. But more importantly, at 10 o'clock that morning, the president was supposed to be at NATO to give the talk at NATO. I'm writing the president's speech, and I don't know what to say. So I'm calling to my negotiating guys. I said, you know, Bob, I'm writing the speech. Is it a happy speech? Is it a good ending? He said, I don't know yet, but Gorby just caved on a big point. I said, okay. Yeah, it's getting about 1:30. I called. I said, Bob, you know, they're picking up all, they were taking all of our, all, we didn't have computers, we had electric typewriters. I said, they're taking, I'm writing the speech. He said, hey, it's going to be a good outcome. Gorby just caved on SDI. Okay, so I wrote the president's speech for NATO. And indeed, the summit ended triumphantly for both of them. Why did Gorby do that? I think he was so cognizant of the internal economic difficulties and the military that he needed a successful meeting as much as Reagan. So this was a high point. And I'm getting ready to go with the president to NATO. You can see I'm pretty wiped out after 3 days. And I hadn't even been drinking, John. But we're getting on Air Force One, and then we went to NATO, and the president did well. And then I dropped off there, and they went back, and he spoke to Congress that night, and it was just a wonderful thing. So we come out of 85, we're in 1986. The president, here he's with Paul Axel and Bob List. He's at the University of Nevada. He's feeling good. Things are really going well. And then we go to the next meeting. Gorby calls up and said, hey, wrote a letter. He said, Mr. Ron, we haven't really talked in a while. Before we have our next summit, let's just have a mini get-together and let's just continue the conversation, not an official summit. in Reykjavik or London. So the president wrote back and said, sure. And I'm thinking, 10 days? We had 10 days to get ready. And I said, we're having an argument within the White House staff. I said, look, we only got 10 days. He's got to do this. And they said, no, this is midterm elections, 86. He's got to be on the road to support candidates. I said, no, he's not going to be on the road. He is going to, he said, yeah, and he's making two stops in Nevada for your friend Jim Santini. And I said, oh, okay. But then I came home talking to Sue Ellen, and I said, well, she said, what are you doing? And I told her what we're doing. And I said, but we're not going to get too worried. It's just a shake hands, and Raisa Gorbachev is not coming. So I remember saying, you know, Gorby got his clock cleaned in Geneva. He's not coming for another handshake. And she was right. Gorby came loaded for bear. Mrs. Gorbachev came, Raisa Gorbacheva. The meetings went really well initially, and they began talking about the most far-racing diminution of arms. Remember, the President Reagan was one of the most strident anti-nuclear people. He was constantly talking about getting rid of nuclear weapons. We'd be in an Oval Office meeting, and he would say, well, to Schultz, well, George, why don't we just propose to Gorbachev to outlaw, abolish nuclear weapons? And Schultz was different than he is today. And Weinberg would sit there and go, well, Mr. President, that's a good idea, but they got superior conventional forces. We can't do it now. And he said, well, all right. But we knew when he got the chance, and that's what happened at Reykjavik, they were talking almost abolishment of nuclear weapons, 50% cuts in BMs. Big cuts in naval missiles, but it all came down to Strategic Defense Initiative. One thing, were we going to confine it to the laboratory, as Gorbachev insisted, or could we test it? And in the end, they couldn't resolve that. Both the two of them held firm on what would have been an extraordinarily far-reaching agreement. And in the end, right here, Gorby turned to Reagan and said, Mr. President, I don't know what else we could have done. And Reagan said, Mr. General Secretary, you could have said yes. So it appeared that the meeting was a failure. And we came back kind of dispirited, but nonetheless, okay, we've really done some, laid some groundwork for far-reaching talks. Then suddenly the bottom dropped out in the White House. I can remember reading the Washington Post, and there was a report from a Lebanese newspaper saying that the U.S. was selling arms to Iran. So I went by the executive secretary. I said, oh, what, by the way, Bob, what was that funny article in the paper? He said, don't ask. I went up to see my friend Ollie. Ollie and I had been there together for 3 or 4 years. And, I mean, he and Fawn Hall were madly stuffing documents into the shredding machine as fast as they could. And he was gone the next day. The president was almost impeached. I think he was saved by Ed Meese as attorney general. The president went into a funk. We didn't know it. Mrs. Reagan began consulting the astrologer. So things had really turned downhill. So bad that the White House staff was shaken up. Don Regan was fired. Actually, he had gone just before that. But the National Security Advisor, John Poindexter, was fired. And they brought in a new team headed by a gentleman there, a small gentleman, Frank Carlucci, Ambassador Carlucci, wonderful guy. And Colin Powell had worked very closely with Cap Weinberger, and they both wanted Colin to come over to be the Deputy National Security Advisor. So Frank Carlucci called him, and Colin had just gotten to Europe, just gotten a third star, just gotten a corps. He commands two divisions, an armored cav regiment, runs around in his own train, and Carlucci calls me and says, Colin, you're the only guy that can do this. You've got to come back and be my deputy. He says, you know, Frank, I love you. I'd do anything for you, but I can't. 2 days later, Carlucci says, you know, Colin, you got to come back. We've talked about everybody. You're the only guy that can be my deputy. And he said, Frank, I got to be here. I'm with the Army. I can't do it. Next day, Colin gets a call. Colin, this is the president. I'd really like you to come back. So Colin came back to be there. I'll tell you one quick story. We're in Colin's office, which is the size of a shoebox. You know, he's the Deputy National Security Advisor. It's about 6x6. We're having some of these interminable arguments between State and Defense. Assistant Secretary Rick Burt, Assistant Secretary Rich Pearl are screaming at each other. The CIA guys, and I'm in there. And suddenly Colin's sitting there, and he looks out the window. I said, sir, are you with us? You okay? He said, Ty, 6 weeks ago I had my own railroad. But he was a tremendous influence. And we got things back on track. We invited Gorbachev to the United States. They picked up where they left off. We signed the immediate, as I wrap this up, We signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, getting very close to our zero-zero option in Europe. We did that in 1987. In 1988, even though we were making progress, Reagan was not about to relent. He made a famous speech where? In Berlin, in front of the Brandenburg Gate, and you can see the horrible wall behind it. And Reagan uttered those famous words, "Mr. Gorbachev, if you truly want peace, tear down this wall." But despite that kind of harsh rhetoric, and it did set Gorby off a little bit, but they got back on track, and they signed shortly thereafter the START agreement, which just expired recently. Reagan made a triumphant visit to Moscow in 1988, cemented a friendship, I think, with Gorbachev forever. This is just before the end of the administration. And then invited later on, I love this photo, invited General Secretary Gorbachev to come visit him at his ranch. And I think Reagan at that time could look back, because shortly after he left office, the Berlin Wall did come down. The two Germanys were reunited. A united Germany joined NATO, and 3 years later, the Soviet Union collapsed. So I would say, in summary, quoting President Reagan in his last address from the Oval Office, as he reflected back on his years in office, he said, "You know, I've always striven to achieve for the United States to be that shining city on the hill." And he said, "My friends, we made the city freer, and we left her in good hands. All in all, not bad at all." And I would agree, Mr. President, not bad, not bad at all. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Tyrus Cobb, former Special Assistant for National Security Affairs to President Ronald Reagan. It's now time for our audience question period and answer. We have a number of questions, so let's begin. First one, Dr. Cobb, biographer Lou Cannon and other historians have noted that a great ability of President Reagan was to, quote, "get stuff done, regardless of ideology." What was the president like during meetings with his cabinet and advisors as he attempted to get things done?
The president was really strong on certain things. He was didn't want any more regulatory regime. He was pro-life, and he had wanted to do the defense bill up against some people's advice. But what frustrated the president was that he saw so many people running off in different directions that was not in sync with his policy, but they all thought that they spoke for the president. And they were all little Reaganites. And so if you disagreed with him, they would say, "Well, you're not a true Reaganite, Ty, or, you know, or Fred, you know," and because Reagan would do this. And I remember the president, Skip, saying it near the end of his term, "Well, I don't know what else I am, but I'll tell you one thing, I am not a Reaganite." It was the civility that was there, to be firm when he had to be.
Next question. Do you think that President Reagan would recognize the Republican Party today if he were still alive? What do you think his opinion would be of the current Tea Party movement?
The president would probably have shared a lot of the goals of the Tea Party conservatives. That is, he wanted fiscal discipline brought back. He would have been, even though the deficit soared, we thought, at the time under Reagan, it was nothing like what has happened under George Bush and now Barack Obama. I think the president would share those perspectives. I think he would be badly dismayed by the language and the lack of civility and discourse that characterizes American politics today, the rise of talk radio and the vehemence and the call to Second Amendment solutions. These were not Reagan's approach to politics. Above all, I think he emphasized civility.
What do you think of Ron Reagan Jr.'s assertion that President Reagan exhibits signs of Alzheimer while in office?
I would note, Skip, that none of the doctors have ever said there was any indication. nothing in the medical examinations and nothing is in his behavior. We have one person, his dissident son, writing a book that is going to bring him a certain amount of notoriety and sell a lot of books, but it needed something sexy. So I don't share that. I was with the president, I think, a number of occasions, and I'll be the first to say there were times when the president just wasn't interested in talking about Parma ham exports from Italy, you know, and you could see him go like that. As far as a lack of mental acuity during his term, I have not seen anybody close to the president say that.
President Reagan found himself with a lower approval rating than President Obama currently does at this point in his presidency and managed to turn things around. What lessons could President Obama learn from President Reagan in this regard?
You know, that's an absolutely true statement. I remember saying in 1983, I said to my friend Al, I said, you know, we're doomed to one-term presidents. Nobody can ever get reelected. And presidents, his popularity had been down, the economy appeared to be in the tank, the military buildup hadn't really reached fruition, and we suffered from a lack of confidence. But I've written on this, what I think the president would have told Obama, where he slipped a year or two ago, focus on what's really important, Barack. You know, you're all over the map. You love to speechify. You're off on this initiative. You're over here. Decide the two or three things you really want to do and find a way to achieve them. Secondly, push to the limit you can to achieve your goals, but at the last minute, when you know you've gone as far as you can, seek a compromise, get 75%. Don't try to get the whole ball of wax. And I think finally he would say, show humility and have a sense of humor. And I got to tell you, President Obama did that in Tucson. I think he sounded like Reagan in Tucson. It's a different president, and I think it's one that's obviously helped him.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our guest tonight is Dr. Tyrus Cobb, former Special Assistant for National Security Affairs to President Ronald Reagan, who is discussing the personal and professional legacy of President Reagan on the occasion of his upcoming 100th birthday. Next question, Dr. Cobb. Do you think President Reagan would have been surprised by the ways in which current conservatives practically worship his presidency and have popularized the phrase, what would Reagan do?
Yeah, well, what Reagan would do would be whatever that person happened to want. And we, you know, we hear that all the time. It's so funny to us because with those of us that were there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in that sweat box and looking at what Lou Cannon, among others, were saying, and the blistering he'd get from the Washington Post or the New York Times on a daily basis, and where are we going to ever get anywhere? Things really didn't look so good at the time. But, you know, what I would say is if you would do what Reagan did and understand that he could take a detached view, he could step back, he could diffuse the situation with his extraordinary sense of humor, he could bring civility to discussions even between the most animated adversaries at the table. And to his credit, he was also decisive when the time needed to be. If I were to say what would Reagan do, those are things in my mind that he would do.
Here's a real hardball one. What's the real story behind Reagan's love of jelly beans? Were they useful in negotiations?
He loved the jelly beans and he used them as a prop. You know, what we would do is before a meeting, we'd be, say, not so much in the Oval Office, but right next to it, the cabinet room, and we'd always sit there and wait for the president. And the president would come in, and everybody would stand up and say, Mr. President, he'd come in with that jar of jelly beans. I was often seated right behind him, you know, because I'm a note taker, no other reason. But and the president would come in, and you know, he'd pass the jelly beans to you and pass them around. It was a way that really diffused any tension in the room and made everybody feel at ease. One day, though, we were getting ready for a meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister, and we all love Brian Mulroney, but God dang, you know, the Canadians had reneged on the 3% defense commitment of the GNP. They had not helped us on the testing of cruise missiles over the Arctic. They were not very supportive on Central America. And, you know, there were some issues like that. And I said, you know, George Shultz and Cap, and we all talked and said, you know, it's time to, you know, talk a little stronger. And we've got to get the Canadians on board. So, okay, I wrote the president's package that way. Well, we're getting ready for the meeting before the prime minister came. And the president didn't come. And the door opens, and instead of the jelly beans and a smile, the president's got a frown on his face, and he walks in that room and said, I don't know who wrote these talking points, but I want you to know I don't talk to Brian Mulroney this way. Whoa. So I thought, well, call her PAC. We're going back to West Point. We're not being here anymore. So there's a tension in the room, and the president was kind of like this, and so now it's time for Secretary Weinberger to speak, you know, and he's got his strong talking points. So the president turned to him and says, well, Cap. Cap thought for a minute, and he said, well, Mr. President, the good news is that in terms of defense spending, Canada has just surged ahead of Luxembourg. So the president said, okay, I understand, but you sure. So we were okay.
This questioner asks, the U.S. supplied money, artillery, and manpower to various governments in Central and South America to fight communism. Why wasn't more investigations undertaken to learn about these governments and their corruption? The majority of people were simply fighting for the right to provide food, shelter, and education for their families. Latin America has a long history of contrary power to the few and exploiting the population. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I would disagree. You know, when the Sandinistas came to power in Nicaragua and Ortega, President Carter, we initially supported the Sandinistas because we agreed with their goals, and, you know, and they had overthrown a military dictatorship. But it soon became very clear that what was happening in Nicaragua was that this was a Marxist regime under communist influence, with a strong Soviet role being played and Cuban role in Nicaragua. And the people were not by any means supportive of Ortega by that time, and they were more supportive of the resistance or the rebels. We were supporting the democratic forces, which came to be known as the Contras. But where we ran into problems is that in 1986, the Congress passed the Bolin Amendment that prohibited any assistance to the Contras, and people like Ollie North took it upon themselves in this clever scheme, it seemed, I guess, clever at the time, to sell arms to the Iranians, take the profits from that, and fund the Contras, completely in contravention to the law. And that, in the end, really hurt our ability to support the freedom fighters in that area. But in honesty, yes, and many times Obama's in the same situation. Look what he's doing in Egypt. Is he calling for the overthrow of Mubarak? No. Is he calling for the overthrow of the king in Saudi Arabia, a very repressive regime? No. Did he call for the overthrow of the Tunisian corrupt government? No. You know, you have certain ideals, but then you have to compromise too. It's a difficult balancing act.
Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and it's this. Dr. Cobb, what's the most poignant story you have about President Ronald Reagan?
There were several times, you know, when 1986, the Challenger disaster, when the Challenger blew up shortly after takeoff, and Krista McAuliffe was on board. That was a difficult moment. On a more positive note, it was very emotional at D-Day and at the Pointe du Hoc, and the special forces, the Rangers, had to scale the cliffs. Were there when he was shot in 1981, but he still managed a sense of humor. Remember, he went into the operating room and he looked up to the doctor and said, are you all Republicans? And Nancy Reagan came running in and looked at him and he said, well, honey, I forgot to duck. But to conclude on that, I do also recall, I only found out later, Tip O'Neill, his adversary, Democratic leader of the House, came over to his bedside while he was laying there on the verge of death, grabbed his hand, knelt down, and prayed with the president. And the president wrote in his memoirs about Hinckley, the guy that tried to kill him. He said, I had hatred in my heart for this individual, but I know he is one of God's children, and I must find a way to forgive him, and I do. So, poignant moments, I would say those are them. Thank you, Skinner.
Our thanks to Dr. Tyrus Cobb, former Special Assistant for National Security Affairs, to President Ronald Reagan. We also thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Skip Rhodes, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.